from the creek bottom at Cave 2, you see these sort of battlements that come out, they're maybe man high up near the cave, and then they extend out a little ways like a buttress. But it was crenulated, it had irregular on it. And then the face of the cave, and then the color of the earth spilling down into and over the talus slope. And that was a very distinctive feature as we dug more, the stain of earth coming down from there. And I remember, too, as I was taking out dirt, I can't remember, it was in 1949 or 50, that this coming in and out, the brilliance of the light with the light falling on this marble around, and the beautiful colors of the marble. And the eyes had a lot of trouble adjusting. And as we got farther back in the cave, it was all the more stressful. I'm sure I didn't wear dark glasses because it would have been an impediment trying to work in there with them dangling around or in a pocket or something to lose. And sometimes I would come out and there would be this marvelous falcons that lived around, and they would be, I remember one was, or more, there may have been a pair of white falcons, and they would come along and sort of play along, sort of barely move forward, probably looking at us. It seemed at arm's length, but of course it was much more than that, but they were probably no more than 30 feet above us. And they'd come along and just sort of slowly move against the wind up, barely moving their wings. And there was always something like that, the beauty of the place, if you were stopped your work, and we worked steadily, and our time was not wasted, but the beauty of the place just was indescribable. In the evenings, sometimes Helya would sit up on a rock, or I would too, and watch the sunset, the sky from this vantage point. Beautiful. When a person walked upstream along the slope, the cave area changed. That is, in the lower canyon, the caves included these hanging holes above the creek bed, stream bed, and higher up this large rock shelter that I just described, and even higher yet, the one, number four, whatever its number is, up at our campsite. And then as you go upstream, somewhat lower down, quite a bit lower down, is Cave 2, and then Cave 9, that's again higher up and higher upstream. But as you got beyond that point, the rock outcroppings retreated to the very, almost the ridge top, and there were talus slopes, steep slopes down from there, but the cutting action of the creek was not in evidence. It was more wastage, frost wastage, probably from rocks, so that there was a long talus slopes up to the headwaters, however long, a mile at the most from there on up to the very head of the creek, in a dry area of barely vegetated rock. But along that upper part were several caves, one of them that we called the Bear Cave, and I crawled in and did a lot of damage. Helya encouraged me in this malfeasance, and at the time, you know, this, I'm joking about it now, but there was not much thought about when things were considered marginal, you could sort of play around in them, and it was probably a bad attitude, but it wasn't solely mine. even the most supposedly sophisticated of these so-called scientists had it. And I went up and on a Sunday, I remember, one time into the bear cave, and of course I had to take the lantern, and I crawled in, and there on my left side was this, I suppose it was a solution feature, a concavity from ancient times where the water had run and had washed out a little basin. If the floor been lower and been no fill in there, you could have just stood there maybe and washed in it like you were in a lavatory. And in this little concavity of marble, there were some broken rocks and things, irregularities, but you could still see that how it was formed. And down in it, there was some ice still. The caves were still freezing in places. The so-called Bear Cave, perhaps number 11 in Larson's numbering, was overall was quite dry. That's probably why it was favorable to bears, and its entrance fill material made it quite low, a slight struggle to crawl in, as I recall. And I did want to make a correction from some previous recording that I've erased about the area of the alcove on the left in the bear cave in which there were bear hairs. And it may be that this was not, as I said, an actual above the cave floor. I don't really know that, because there was a accumulation of fall from the cave roof, but generally these were, in that cave, seemed to be small pieces that had exfoliated or piece by piece had fallen from the ceilings and walls to make the fill. But nevertheless, this concavity that I took to be a shelf could have been a rock fall. I think in that case, though, that the smooth portion would have been face down rather than face up. And moreover, it had ice on it, and so I don't know the bottom profile of the cave at all. I did proceed to partially destroy the cave, and of course Helia was not averse to this. He told me, go ahead, but the fill material, there's a lot of it in the cave. I don't remember if I reached rock bottom, as the expression goes, but once you start to dig in the cave, it caves in on you, because it's very loose. There's no binding material, dirt. And so as I dug down in more or less the center of the cave, I had my lantern there and my shovel and trowel, and there was charcoal bits all scattered through this, and so I was urged to go further looking for my little experience. I would look for profiles or something. They never showed up, because the charcoal was filtered down through all of these. Now there's no way of knowing, at least I didn't have any way of knowing, whether the charcoal originated at the very top, or that some of it also originated all the way down to the bottom. But anyway, it had dribbled, filtered down through this loose rock fill. These were not huge rocks, as I recall. They could be, with some difficulty, they tend to slide out, but they were manageable to shovel out, so it made a huge destruction in the cave, I'm sure. However, when I was listening to Dave Hopkins talking about how bears would paw around and in the cave and reshuffle things, it made me feel a little less badly, because I thought the bears probably had redistributed the material, and that there was no may have been no real stratification there at any time, thanks to bear usage. Nevertheless, the cave with all the charcoal in it, and I don't believe that I collected any because it was scattered everywhere, not knowing what went where and from how, but I went down and then I stopped. And I don't remember, the National Park Service people, of course, were there afterwards, and they probably made a good drawing of the cave. I don't believe that Helya made a detailed drawing, but we went around the caves, as I said before, and we measured caves, so he may have made some of his excellent drawings carefully put on graph paper. They would have had to have been without transit levels or anything like that. And I don't remember worrying inordinately about a bear showing up since it was summer. And we didn't see any bears in 1949, but we certainly saw this, we assumed, a recent springtime plowing of the hillside below the bear so-called bear cave and a little bit farther downstream on the east-facing slope. Of course, when it comes to the question of frozen portions of the cave, which in one sense tend to stabilize it, and if bears were plowing around making a sort of nest, if that's what the H1 did, you wouldn't find much disturbance in those areas which were frozen. There's all, to my experience, none of the caves that we worked in had, most of them had a dry area on the top, generally, and the frozen matrix was below that, below a level of say, strewn rocks. Of course, the more clay soils were, the more frozen they were, the more it took time to do them. And working in, once we got inside cave 2 and in cave 9, when you get past the mouth and you get down a little ways, what level I've forgotten, you hit frozen clays or and with however much of rock is embedded in them. And this was true even, as I recall, to some extent in cave 9, which had better air circulation due to its chimney. But I didn't work perhaps at all or very little. I remember just going, I worked the south-oriented, that is the entrance that opens on the south rather than on the north. And in this difficult wedge-shaped floor, once I got past the entrance, it was frozen. And as we continued down on this wedge, I was the only one that I recall working, because it was too narrow for more than one person, and Helya and Jorn were occupied with the mapping and notation, specimen notation, and just the general observation. But that, of course, is leaping 1 year ahead of my observations. 1 year after, later than my observations about the bear cave in which I plowed through the center of that cave. Another element that came to my knowledge in talking to Dave Hopkins, August 11th, 1995, was the age of the caves. I believe either I or someone else asked him the question how old they were, and he said around, or he may have been just incidental to, and then came into the conversation of how old they were, and he said they're around 2 million years. Therefore, when I was digging in this topmost cave near our tent in 1949 and penetrated this fallen alcove, the roof had fallen in over in the southwest corner of the cave, then there may have been a great time elapsed between that fall, much more than I realized, or hell, you realized, probably didn't know, and the present configuration of the cave. That is, when it was still standing and when it fell, and then until it reached this, or even its late Pleistocene form. I was tempted, always tempted, to go into the collapsed caves, of which there, I'm not sure the number, but there are one or two in one talus slope, and they're sort of, you have to look and then you see there are large interspaces and realize that this must be a fallen cave or caves. And whether some of them, if there were longer and more interconnected caves, there, that is also the possibility that they may come from different epochs, you know, not in the correct geological sense, but that they come from, by the human standards, vastly different time periods of the caves. But that's what his statement was, and I took it to be a general statement about the caves as generality being 2 million years. But I think it is worth pointing out that there may have been generations of caves. They may not be, or probably are, and he would have some opinion on that, of the same cohort, or same generation. I'll probably get back to the to the caves, the actual digging in the caves, to some extent. Now I wanted to say something about the persons who were involved with the caves and were instrumental in making them known, and just important people to me also. The primary one is Taylor Moto Sr., and it was my impression then, and it still is, that Taylor and Alfred's finding of the arrowheads found their way to the University of Alaska independently from David Hopkins' contacts and information. Although probably the combination of two, having the specimens, which were recent and perhaps would not excite Louis Giddings, who was definitely aimed toward an early man search, or hoped to, if he ran across it, he'd certainly give priority to it. And also to some extent, Larson, who was looking for this period before the so-called Neo-Eskimos, slate use, as that was then talked about. But I think that Eskil Anderson was involved with finding the, reporting the Putak site on Point Spencer through the specimens that he got from Mrs. Peterson, where we visited and dug in the Teller area and Port Clarence earlier in the summer of 1949. Eskil, I'm quite sure, was either involved in commercial mining or was in mining extension. I remember that Mark Anthony was another instructor in extension mining But I have the impression that Eskil was too, and would be perhaps earlier in the time period. And so you have Taylor and Alfreds as being probably as important as David in making the caves known to academics and in actually in getting Larsen to go there. I don't think that Larsen had any set idea that he was going to find much in the caves, and I think that his primary search, or at least an equal research, was for Neuroputak sites, although I had never seen his write-up, his project write-up for the Venner Grand money, the $2,000 I mentioned. Taylor is in and of himself is an interesting person, and I'm sure Alfred Carman is too. And Alfred, I assume, had some lap blood, and he died just recently, according to Taylor Moto Jr., who still uses the Jr. despite his being 57 years old. Alfred, I believe, was part lap through his mother. Anyway, he and Taylor, being reindeer herders, had familiarity with the cave areas. And I think it's worth pointing out that in Eskimo communities in the historic period, and almost certainly before the historic period, that there was not equal knowledge, any more than there's equal knowledge of the subject matter in modern industrial society. Perhaps there, you could say, people had a broader knowledge. Nevertheless, people had very special knowledge, and we can't assume that there were a lot of people living who had been around the caves a lot, although I'm sure over time there have been lots and lots of people who went there, as we can see, generations and hundreds of generations of people had spent time at the caves. But at the beginning of the 20th century, around 1900, and I am assuming Taylor was born around 1905, just the same year my father and Helia, for discussion's sake, he seemed to be roughly in the same age group as Helia, in his 40s. That he, as a reindeer herder, had knowledge that a herder in certain areas that somebody else didn't have. And Alfred, I believe, were the only ones that I was told about and that Larsen discussed, and I believe that Taylor might have mentioned other people who knew the caves, but he didn't. And I don't know the entire population who all was herding reindeer in the 1928. Before the reindeer period, say beginning in 1892, and back in probably into the 1870s, the interior of Seward Peninsula was completely devoid of caribou, or the subsequent reindeer, closely related creatures with similar habits. It was completely devoid. It lost its main meat supply for people and for the large carnivores. And so you could be sure that the populations of wolves for sure dropped, and I would think also that the population of brown bears — there are no black bears that I know of on the peninsula — that brown bear populations would have fallen, or at the very least that their distribution would have changed because of the lack of caribou. And the places that people would go was diminished, and their motivation to go inland was diminished greatly in that period, say, for whenever it is, from the 1870s. I'm sure it didn't run into the 1880s very long, if it did. And between then and between the time that reindeer herding got going full bore, that the interior of Seward Peninsula was practically devoid of families, at least, and men, as the dog teams increased in size in the gold rush period in the late 1890s, when whites came in there, of course, whites came through. And I didn't see any signs, as I mentioned, of any graffiti of whites. They had more pressing things like gold on their mind. But the trail, since the trail ran just a short distance over the ridge from the other small drainage from the Cottonwood Creek that goes up into Trail Creek. I mean, Trail Creek itself, like it was called, this little feeder up there, but Cottonwood Creek lies down in the bottom of the canyon and these little feeders come in. And I'm sure that at some time that the whites must have looked around there. Anyway, the frequent use of the area for by caribou hunters just fell off to nothing, and then it resumed, but without the intensity, you might say, of occupation, because these men were not liking to be away from their homes. Eskimos have never in the historic period, at least in Alaska, been renowned for loving to be off by themselves. And although some hunters did, were solitary from choice or necessity, they couldn't get a hunting partner if they had a bad disposition, for instance. Nevertheless, people wanted to stay away from home only for short periods if they could do so and still earn a living from the land. And so even in the reindeer period, I don't think it was an everyday experience for people to stop in at the cave. So I think probably that Taylor and Alford in the 20th century were the only other people who spent any time in the caves before Larson and Lucier did. And theirs was 1928 and ours was 1949 and then again in 1950. And I would suppose that I spent more time in the caves than any other human being in the historic period. How renowned. But people may be curiosity seekers, they would go in, but to spend, you know, days and weeks, even months, bent over inside a cave is not most people's cup of tea. And even Helya, and certainly Jorn Melgor did not spend all of their time down on their knees, as I did, or crouched over. He could be standing and making sketches. So I and Alfred and Taylor, although we're not in the same league as far as knowledge of the country, we together probably spent the most time, since they spent 5 days and I spent a great deal more total time. Unwisely, perhaps. It may be worth also saying the difference between the break in the 20th century, how the land was used, how the caves were viewed, the access to them, was very different in the Gold Rush days and of course back into pre-Gold Rush days when only Inupiat were walking and sledding and moving around on the inland Seward Peninsula, including Trail Creek. Up to and including the 1949, 1950, I would say till 1949-48, and that period, there was no access to Trail Creek except on foot. It was only very late in the 1940s and when the helicopters came into use, that somebody could land, and they would be mappers most likely, from the Geological Survey, could land on Trail Creek, on the ridge there. Otherwise, in the historic and prehistoric periods, people always had to go on foot. Of course, in the early 20th century, there were such things as wagons, believe it or not, running around parts of inland Seward Peninsula, I was told by Grandpa John Kokarik. And there are wagons sitting around in the river valley above Deering, below, south of Deering. So, but ordinarily people didn't walk, they had sled dogs, sled and dogs, and they went at winter. This also would affect the impact that people had on the caves and on the vegetation, because if they were running, depending on the snow, for a running surface, they wouldn't damage the underlying vegetation much, and there were it was a low impact period. But once you get into the snow machine period, you get a lot more people, and then in that would have been the 1960s, as far as I know, the earliest bombardiers. Then in the 1970s or whenever they came in, certainly in the 80s, a widespread use of these all-terrain vehicle, wheel vehicles, tri-wheels and four-wheels. And I'm sure that either people ran around